Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our House Committee on Transportation Policy this lovely Wednesday morning, May 31st, 2017. Ladies and gentlemen, this is my father's 96th birthday today.
So congratulations.
I just want to take a moment and honor my dad.
Sure.
I'm not there to celebrate with him, but my husband's over there having breakfast with him this morning, and I just want to acknowledge this is a very special day in my family. So.
Yeah,
happy birthday to Mr. Richard Duncan Hanen. We will, I think in deference to our two missing committee members, move the work session further down in the agenda. We'll go ahead and open an informational meeting on electric vehicles. Do we have a list? And we are so delighted to have you here this morning. This is, of course, an important topic of conversation. This is in Oregon something that in many quarters is very, very high on the radar. Of course, it's part of what we're discussing in our transportation package. And we're here to listen and learn. So thank you for taking the time to travel here today and enlighten us in any order that you prefer.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much, Chair McCune, Vice Chairs Meeks and Vial, and members of the committee. We're very pleased to be here today and share information with regards to EVs. We do have about 4 to 5 speakers, so I'll go ahead and introduce first the two here, and then I'll be back up to introduce our other two to possibly three. But we'd first like to introduce Zach Hankin, who's with Forth, and he's the program director. He's going to provide an overview of electric vehicles, also known as EVs, as well as Catherine Tebe, who's the Forth program manager, who will also provide an overview of electric vehicle charging infrastructure and information with regards to electric vehicle costs and range. So with that, I'll turn it over.
Thank you, Jeanette. And good morning, everyone. So again, my name is Zach Hankin. I'm from Oregon City. This is Catherine Tebe. So Catherine and I are very much kind of in the fold of electric vehicles. We are thinking about this and charging every day. So today, think of us as a resource. And then moving forward, if you ever have questions regarding plug-in vehicles, charging, et cetera, we're the people that can provide an objective answer and ideally educate you so that you can know what decisions are most apt for what you're looking at. How are we controlling that? Okay. So I'm going to work through a number of these slides, and her and I are going to tag team this, so you get a little bit of both of us. But as a bit of background, we've rebranded. So formerly, we were Drive Oregon. We were born out of the Oregon Innovation Council as a 501c6. We also have a 501c3, so doing both arms of the nonprofit, but really had our base in growing the Oregon electric vehicle industry and economic arms. We have had a lot of success with jobs in Oregon related to this space. Going forward, we're now Forth, and this allows us to really embrace not just driving, but also riding. So not only bicycles, motorcycles, scooters, neighborhood electric vehicles, a little bit of everything, and it also allows us to take a regional approach so we can collaborate with some people across the border. And with that, I'll hand it over to Catherine.
Welcome.
Good morning. Okay, so we're going to start with
Em, I'll need your name for the record, please.
Oh, Catherine Tebe with Forth. So we're going to start with the different types of electric vehicles. There are three main types of vehicles. The first is battery electric vehicle. These are 100% electric. You will never go to a gas station in these vehicles unless you're going to use the restroom, pick up some snacks, maybe even charge your car, but you will never fill these cars with gas. The second type of vehicle is a plug-in hybrid, or a PHEV. These are both electric and gasoline powered. So the one pictured is a Prius Prime. A Ford C-Max Energy is also another option. These are really great in rural areas, areas where there's less infrastructure, or where you might have a 10-mile commute, and you can do that commute all electric. The third type of electric vehicle is electric extended range vehicle. Now, these are primarily electric. There are only two vehicles that fall into this category, the Chevy Volt with a V, and that's a plug-in.
Information.
hybrid or extended range electric vehicle, and the BMW i3 with a Rex. So these are primarily electric, so the Volt goes about 40 to 60 miles all electric before a gasoline engine kicks in. It has a 6.6 gallon gas tank. And the BMW i3 with a Rex has about an 80 to 100 mile range all electric before the gasoline engine kicks in. So these are a really great option for people who maybe live in the suburbs, or the Chevy Volt is particularly popular with fleets when they want to try out an electric vehicle and they want to drive electric as much as they can, but they're a little worried about people not plugging in. So these are the three main types. So available models. In the state of Oregon, over 20 models are available today. And in the next year or so, there should be even more models, and more of these models will have longer ranges. More of them will have 200-mile-plus ranges. But these are just some of the options. Everything from a Nissan Leaf to the Kia Soul EV to the Tesla that everyone has heard about. More body styles are also becoming available. The Chevy Bolt EV in the top left corner is a compact SUV. So this is great for people who maybe spend a little more time outdoors, they like to go hiking, or they need something with more cargo space. So on to charging. How do you charge these vehicles? Yes, there are over 20 models. There are three different types of main vehicles, but where do you plug in? Where do you get your fuel source? So there are three different types of charging, level one, level two, and then level three, which is also known as DC fast charging. Level one is just plugging into any grounded wall outlet. So any wall outlet in your garage, you can plug a car into. Every car comes with a charger in the trunk that you can just plug in and go. This is a really slow charge, so this is 3 to 5 miles per hour. So if you need to drive 200 miles a day and you have a full battery electric vehicle, this isn't going to work for you. But if you have a plug-in hybrid, you don't need to install a home charger. You don't need to worry about running conduit lines or calling an electrician. You can usually just plug in. Level two is the most popular, and that's used oftentimes in home applications. So a lot of people choose to install a level two charger. This is almost necessary if you drive a Chevy Bolt EV or a Tesla and you drive more than 50 miles a day. A lot of public chargers are also level two. So at your grocery store, at Fred Meyer, this is where you'll find level twos. And those charge between 12 and 40 miles per hour, depending on the charger and how much electricity it's outputting. And then level three is DC fast charging. And these charge really, really quickly. So 35 to 100 miles per hour. These are great for road trips or if you drive a lot in a day. We found that in the city of Portland, Uber and Lyft drivers are using these a lot to charge their cars so that they can get more rides in. And this infrastructure is changing the most. It's becoming the quickest, but it's also the most expensive. So this is a level of charging that you will never see in a home. It just requires way too much power for that, and it's too expensive. One thing to note about this is that there are currently three competing standards. So for level one and level two, pretty much any charger that you pull up to, with the exception of Tesla chargers, any car, regardless of their model and make, can use that charger. With a level three, there's a Japanese standard called CHAdeMO that's used by companies like Nissan and Kia. And then there's the CCS combo standard, which is an American and European standard used by companies like Chevrolet, BMW. And then there's the Tesla standard, which only Teslas can use.
So may I, if you pull up to a charging station and you have a car, are all three of those generally available? And can you damage your vehicle if you plug in? How does this work when you have three different standards? Right. And how long is it going to be before the Betamax goes away, in essence?
Yeah. That's a great question, Chair McKeon. So the answer to that is, one, you won't damage your car. Essentially, these standards are just like plugs. So if you have an Android phone and you try to plug an Apple cord into it,
it won't work.
It won't damage your phone. And currently, most fast chargers that are installed have both the Japanese standard and the CCS combo standard, or the American European standard. They're called dual standard chargers, and right now, because there are so many cars made by manufacturers that use both standards, it just makes the most sense from a manufacturing standpoint to manufacture those chargers with both standards. It's cheaper to do that rather than to make separate chargers for each standard and then try and sell those. Okay. The Tesla standard's totally different. That's something that really only Tesla plays with. But if you go up to any general level 3 charger, they will have both.
And is there a, between those three, if you're rapid charging or slow charging, is there any implications for battery life depending on whether you're rapid charging or slow charging? How does that work with the wear and tear on your battery?
Right. So in earlier models of vehicles, so the early Nissan Leafs from 2011, those saw pretty high levels of battery degradation for a variety of reasons. One thought about why those faced higher rates of battery degradation was because of the fast charging and the stress that it puts on the battery. With current models, battery technology has advanced so quickly in 5 years that we're not really too concerned about that. And people are really only using these, unless they're Uber and Lyft drivers in major cities, they're really only using them for road trips or to go visit family in Eugene if they're from Portland or to go to Spokane from Hood River. That's kind of what these chargers are for.
So am I hearing you say that there is more degradation with the fast charging? Or is there is not any more as the technology is improving?
We really only saw it with early models,
okay,
from what we can tell.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And that's true of all battery degradation. The batteries in general, we've seen degradation just pretty much drop off. So what do they look like? So the charger that comes with each car looks like the first one under level one. That's what you'll find in your trunk. They weigh anywhere between 3 and 5 pounds. They're pretty lightweight. And you'll see that it just plugs into a 110 outlet on the other end. And then the level two that I have pictured is a Schneider Electric station. This is what you'll see generally in fleet applications or for workplace charging. They're a little bit bigger, and they have, this one has two chargers for multiple vehicles. And then the last one is a picture of an ABB charger that is a DC fast charger, and you'll see that it has both the American standard, American European standard, and the Japanese standard. And so that's typical of a fast charger. So in terms of fuel consumption, these vehicles...
Sorry to interrupt, Madam Chair. last night I plugged in up in the basement of the Hillsboro Civic Center, and now it strikes me I have no idea whether I plugged into a level 2 or a level 3. My recollection, it's blink, and I got a little card in the mail that let me swipe it and plugged in. But I noticed that I got a really lot of charge in about an hour and a half. What was I connected to?
Okay, so you know it was a blink charger. Do you know, was it a really large unit, or was it like a pedestal unit, kind of small?
Since it was in a basement, I could pretty much promise it was a level 2 charger.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Chair. Please continue.
Okay. So in terms of fuel consumption, so these vehicles use no fuel if they're full battery electric, and depending on how you're driving a plug-in hybrid or an extended range electric vehicle, you will also be using very little fuel. So it can save a lot of money. The price of batteries is coming down, the price of the vehicles is coming down, and so you're really just, it's all about the money savings. In addition to saving money on fuel consumption, you will also not need oil changes or need fewer oil changes, and you'll need fewer brake pad replacements because these cars use regenerative braking. So the second row is gasoline hybrid vehicles. So that's
Regenerative braking.
Yes.
How does that save on brake pads?
Yeah. So what that essentially means is that the car is... It's a little hard to explain, but the car, it brakes, or I don't...
generates electricity
so,
while it's
yeah.
braking.
So, yeah.
How does that say brake pads?
So we have the motor, the electric motor, that is generating the inertia that's making the car go. And when that motor is turning backwards, it acts as a generator. But it has drag on...
So it's like compression,
yeah.
kind of?
It's a drag, yeah. when it's...
Really it's a drag.
It's like downshifting
yeah.
kind of?
Exactly.
Okay.
Like downshifting.
And so you won't press on the brake as often.
Okay, got
with
it.
With some models, you can essentially drive them without ever touching the brake at all.
Yeah, thank you.
And you'll see that savings in gasoline hybrid vehicles, too. So you'll see that in Toyota Priuses, that they don't need as many brake pad replacements also. And then the last row is just regular gasoline-powered vehicles that would average 27 mpg. So specifically in Oregon, we have some of the best energy in the nation in terms of it being really clean. It's also really cheap compared to other parts of the nation. And a lot of it is locally generated. And so you're putting more money into the local economy by driving electric in the state of Oregon. And you're keeping that money locally as opposed to buying foreign oil. And so the cost of driving 100 miles, this is from the Union of Concerned Scientists, in the state of Oregon, is clearly a lot less.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
That, if you go back to that slide, does that electric cost reflect what you pay at home, or does that reflect what you would pay at a public charging station?
Good question, Chair McCune, Vice Chair Vile. That would be at home, so probably an average of 10 cents per kilowatt hour.
And what's it cost? Follow up, sorry, Madam Chair. What's it cost at a public charging station? What did I pay yesterday, for example?
Right, and that depends largely on the network that you're charging on, and it could range anywhere between that 10 cents per kilowatt hour to a dollar an hour.
Holy cow. And is there anything on those that tells you how much you're paying per kilowatt hour?
Yes. Generally, because they're membership-based, it would be part of the terms and conditions or part of what you're agreeing to when we plugged in when we first got here as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bretto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as we start looking at more and more electric vehicles, and right now the power companies have to have a renewable portfolio standard where they either, since hydro is not considered renewable, they have to have either solar or wind. I would assume most of these cars would get plugged in the evening when someone goes home, where solar is no longer producing in the evening. Well, how would this affect the grid and that portfolio standard going on from here? Because solar is certainly not as affordable as the hydro that we're buying from Bonneville. So have you guys looked down the road as far as where electric cars are going and how much load that's going to put on the grid and where you're going to get that energy?
Mm-hmm. Chair McCune, Representative Barreto. Yeah, and it's complicated. So to begin with, there's what are known as time of use rates to incentivize people to charge off grid, off peak, so that there isn't a huge demand spike at 7 p.m., which is when most people are getting home and plugging in. And that'll encourage people to charge when we are, frankly, getting rid of energy because of the amount of wind generation that's going on. There's also in work done by the utilities to look at how they can directly interact with that charger so that if there is peak demand, they can ramp down the electricity going to your car, as well as ramping it up so that you're getting the most amount of charge when there's the most amount of electricity and it's best for the grid. So they're covering it from both angles here in Oregon. And we can look to other places that have more complicated grids to look at how they're managing that. And they're doing it in such ways which are kind of incentivizing it on one end to say, we'll pay you more or charge you less to charge when we want you to charge, and as well as we'll interact with your car so that we can have a handle on it.
Okay.
There's also, we've heard concern from Lane County and Eugene that they have too much solar in the middle of the day, and so they're trying to encourage fleets to buy plug-in vehicles because they can charge in the middle of the day or provide employee charging.
Follow-up?
Yeah, so if I don't want to go back to the how many kilowatts an hour you can charge, whether it's fast or slow charge. But as far as solar panels, if someone did have a solar panel on the top of their car, how much area would they need to continually produce during the day if they just parked out in a parking lot and used a solar panel? I mean, would a 5 foot by 4 foot panel produce much for them during the day?
Chair McCune, Representative Barreto, I'm a big solar fan, so happy to talk about the interaction between solar PV and EV. Generally, it's for the average amount of driving that we're seeing, which is about 10,000 miles, you need about a 3 kW system. So that's about 10 to 14 panels, depending on the capacity of those panels.
We have Representative Wilson and then Representative Klein, and then we'll need to move on.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I think I'll forget it. Representative Barreto kind of peppered around my interest area there. So,
thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Representative McLean.
This may be something that you covered before I came in, but did you talk at all about the tax rebate for electric cars and how long you think the industry believes that that is helpful and really necessary?
Chair McCune and Representative McLean, we have not. We have another additional speaker who will be coming up who could speak to that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So I do want to underscore the cost of driving an EV. I've driven, our family has driven an electric vehicle for about 3 years. My wife is in education. I work for a nonprofit. We have two young boys. We are very much getting by on we're not the Rockefellers. We are, in deciding to buy an electric vehicle, we looked very much on that cost of ownership question. And by looking at how much we were paying on gas, we were able to justify owning and driving an EV based on what we would be saving per month. And it was significant. So we were paying about $200 or $300 a month in gas from our mutual commutes. And then we were able to get into, at the time, a Spark EV, which we've now put 30,000 miles on. So I happily got another EV just recently replacing that Spark because our lease was over. But it was an easy justification to say, let's continue driving. This fits for our use case. And this works for our two kids who have longer legs, and so we wanted a slightly longer car. So a little bit on the electric vehicle ranges. So what we have here is a slide depicting the ranges of both the battery electric cars, the extended range hybrids, as well as the plug-in hybrids. So Kia Soul EV, Nissan Leaf, are on the low end. These are cars that have a range between 80 and 100 miles. That's what we would consider the typical range for an electric vehicle. That generally fits very well for a normal commute shed, so anywhere between 20 and 30 miles each way. I'll point out that the average commute length in Oregon is around 22 miles. So it would cover that as a daily trip quite well. The big battery EVs are coming with the Bolt EV, the Nissan EV, as well as, of course, we will acknowledge Tesla and what they do, which can allow, you know, going all the way to Seattle without having to charge.
I think Representative Wilson and Representative Barreto and I fall into a different category there.
I believe it, but that's why we have lots of options. Well, and that's where some of these other options are also great, is the plug-in hybrids, where you can drive to Bend. You can drive all over the state, and where you can plug in, you don't need to plug in. Additionally, some of these larger cars, like the Pacifica Hybrid, which is a minivan, it's a plug-in hybrid. It has a relatively low range for the battery. It's only about, it's under 30 miles. But if you have a short commute, and you can drive on all electric, and then take that on a longer trip if you want. This one illustrates the prices of the cars. So there is an opportunity with the number of vehicles being available that are off lease. And so many of these cars were heavily incentivized, both by the manufacturer, both through federal tax credit, that they can be had for a bargain when they're 3 or 4 years old. Something that might have had a price of $35,000 can be had for $10,000, and it's only 3 years later. Otherwise, the cars are still expensive. We see a lot of lease deals where you can have a good monthly payment, but in most cases, there is a down payment that you have to overcome in order to get into those cars. But leases are by far the most popular way people are choosing to buy these. So just a few slides on resiliency. So, anecdotally,
we'll need to move a little bit along. I want to make sure that the other panels have an opportunity. We've given you guys an extra 10 minutes. So,
okay. Well,
thank you.
Power through these.
Thanks.
So we've gotten some anecdotal information from Hurricane Sandy, from the Fukushima disaster, about the benefits of electric vehicles. One of which is just the larger fleet diversity. In a lot of cases, the when power was restored, which is always done with the greatest urgency, power is restored in a couple days. Usually, gas, natural gas, etc., takes weeks, if not months. So, in seeing fleets that had electric vehicles that could operate, that has been a benefit to the people that they were serving. And so, as we're working with partners such as Energy Trust, such as those that are running resiliency centers, that has been increasingly a part of their plan, is how can they continue their operations in a case where gas, diesel, natural gas is a rarity. So this is the last slide. So acknowledging that we do have concerns for the Cascadia subduction zone potential disaster, I want to acknowledge that what has led to the great amount of cars that we do have available is this 8-state zero emission mandate, which has this big goal of how many vehicles will need to be operating in the United States by 2025. And then the Oregon Global Warming Commission goal, which is also a rather lofty goal that we need to hit in order to abate our greenhouse gas emissions. So with that, I would welcome any questions, and I know we have some other good speakers coming up.
Representative Vile.
Just a quick question, Madam Chair, and if this isn't the right panel, please let me know. Is sabotage, electromagnetic type of sabotage, a greater fear on electric cars than it is on our standard gas-driven cars?
Chairman Kuhn, Representative Vile, no, I don't think so. And I say this because I'm a car nerd primarily, and so I look at really all vehicles that are out there, and if any of them are susceptible, they're all susceptible because they're all using very similar back ends, data sets, et cetera.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for your testimony today. This is obviously a topic that we will continue to visit over time, and we appreciate your time and your expertise. I think we've asked the majority of our questions along the way, too, so we will call up our next panel. Ross Good, Jana Gastelum, and Mike Fries, please.
Yeah, and Chair McCune and Vice Chairs Meek and Vile, I was so excited about your father's 96th birthday.
Oh,
I forgot to introduce myself, so I want to happy birthday to your father.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm Jeanette Shaw with Forth. I direct our Government Affairs Department.
So. Very nice to have you here today. Good morning. Welcome. Welcome to our committee.
Ladies first.
All right, we have a very polite panel up here. Thank you both. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jana Gastelum. I'm the Climate Program Director for the Oregon Environmental Council, and thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. And I just also want to say thank you for all your work on transportation issues as well. I know this is a big and complex session, and transportation is so important to all of us for how we get to work, how we play, how we get to the grocery store and medical appointments. And we very much want to see, you know, good transportation things come out of the session. So thank you so much for your work. I'm here, however, to talk about some of the unintended consequences of our transportation system. And it's not just time lost stuck in traffic, but also the pollution that can come from relying primarily on petroleum-based transportation. Our transportation system is the largest source of our climate pollution in the state. About 37% of Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions come from transportation. back at the beginning of this decade in 2010, those emissions were starting to decline and level off. But in the last 4 years, they've actually been growing again. And that's primarily because we have more vehicles on the road and people are also traveling more vehicle miles. So we're actually seeing that instead of continuing on that declining trend, our transportation climate pollution is actually increasing, which is not the direction that we want it to go. There are definitely solutions to reducing that pollution. And back in 2013, after 2 years of study, the state put together a statewide transportation strategy looking at how we could reach our 2050, our long-term climate goals. And that study found that we need every tool in the toolbox to reduce emissions. We need to increase freight efficiency. We need congestion pricing. We need greater use of transit. But really importantly, we also need electric vehicles. And there are two reasons for that. One, as I think was sort of pointed out before, electric vehicles are just inherently more efficient. They put more of the energy into moving a vehicle forward. There's less energy loss to excess heat and friction. And so you can go further on less amount of energy. And then we can also decarbonize our electric power. We have a lot of hydropower that already is low carbon, but we also have opportunities for wind and solar and geothermal and other renewable energy development. And so that combination of superior efficiency as well as low carbon energy make electric vehicles a really critical tool for reducing climate pollution in Oregon. But to really make a dent in those emissions, we have to look at increasing the number of electric vehicles on our roads. And the statewide transportation strategy says that really to be on track, we need by 2035 to have 65% of new vehicle sales be electric vehicles. And that by 2050, we need that to be about 95% of all new passenger vehicles to be some electric model. And we're not really on that growth trajectory now, and so we need additional public policy to get us there. Switching gears a little bit, electric vehicles not only reduce climate pollution, but they also reduce toxic air pollution that really damages our health. Right now, gasoline and diesel contain a lot of toxic air emissions that contribute to cancer and premature deaths. Some of these toxins include things like benzene, toluene, xylenes, formaldehyde, and then diesel particulate matter. And diesel soot is particularly harmful to human health. Basically, you have these little particles and toxics can hitch a ride and circulate throughout all of our bodies. It impacts our hearts and our lungs and our brains. Diesel exhaust is linked to strokes, heart attacks, asthma, and other diseases. Now, we've had progress. So we've had federal vehicle and fuel standards that have reduced the amount of toxics emitted by individual vehicles. But those air quality benefits are lost when we have more vehicles on the road and increasing vehicle miles traveled, as we've seen. And we're facing the real likelihood that the federal government could roll back some of those fuel economy standards as well. So I will submit the rest of this in writing because I know you are short on time. But it is important to know that vehicle pollution not only affects those of us who are kind of walking around and breathing and live near busy roadways, but also prenatal health. A study was done in 2015 when I myself was pregnant with my second child that pregnant women who are exposed to high levels of traffic pollution actually have children who have reduced white matter development in their brains, and that's linked to things like ADHD, aggression, and lower cognitive processing. And so this is a real equity and health issue as well. Electric vehicles deliver benefits the moment that they're on the road in reducing both climate pollution and toxic air pollution. And I hope we can extend the benefits to all Oregonians, whether rural or low income, or especially for people who live near busy roadways. Thank you. Great.
Thank you so much. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. My name is Ross Good. I'm with Fiat Chrysler Automobiles. I'm state a government relations manager for the Western States. I live and reside in Sacramento, California.
Thank you for traveling up here today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Thank you. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was asked by Jeanette to do a few things, basically sort of give you an update on where we're at with electric vehicles in the state of Oregon, then discuss some barriers to electric vehicle adoption or acceptance in the state, and then lastly talk about some incentives or things we can do to make the acceptance of these vehicles more widespread. I'm also an engineer. I come from Detroit, so if you have vehicle questions, I'm glad to address those as well. But so far in the state, most recent year for which we have statistics, 2016, there were just over 3,400 ZEVs, zero-emission vehicles, sold in the state, which sounds like a pretty good number, but it really represents less than 2% of the sales. So when Zach mentioned earlier, and others have mentioned the aggressive targets for 3.3 million vehicles in the ZEV states, or the eight states that signed the multi-state MOU, 3.3 million vehicles by 2025, we are a long way from that. We have a very steep hill to climb. In fact, since 2011, we've only sold just under 11,500 vehicles in the state. Puts us about ninth on the list in terms of state ZEV sales. Pretty good for per capita results, you know, really encouraging for the number of people in Oregon, but not real good in terms of helping us reach our overall number. And that is with, as they said, 20 vehicles available now. We expect in the next 5 years probably double that number or close to double that number of vehicles coming in. I myself am quite proud of what we've done here so far with the Fiat 500e, which I don't know if you've had a chance to drive, but many people claim that that's the best version of the Fiat 500. It's lower. The weight is lower in the vehicle. It's has great acceleration. It's a lot of fun to drive. In fact, there's many racing enthusiasts who are taking advantage of the low lease rates, buying them just for weekend racers because I can go 100 miles on a charge, and most races are a lot less than that. So it's very good to see that crowd. But then also the Pacifica Hybrid, which comes with a range, all electric range of the first 30 miles. And as Zach mentioned, most commutes are much shorter than that. So that's a great opportunity for families that need a little bit bigger room, or maybe kids with longer legs, as Zach mentioned. But a new minivan entering the market just this year. It is also the highline vehicle in the Chrysler fleet. So it receives the most attention. It receives the most advertising dollars, those types of things. So we're very encouraged by that. Let's discuss a few barriers towards electric fleet adoption. And some of them were mentioned earlier this morning, and where some people see great opportunity, I see a little bit of difficulty. One is charging costs. We see things produced by the Union of Concerned Scientists that say it's this to charge or it's that to charge. Generally, when you see those numbers, those are the best case scenarios. Charging at home when you have a dedicated facility, not using chargers, as you mentioned, commercial chargers, things like that. So when people actually do charge and they do get their bill back, they see, well, that's a heck of a lot more than I was told when I bought the vehicle, and then people are disappointed. It's one thing to be to realize you're going to save some money, but when you don't save or understand you're going to save some money, but then when you don't, there is bitter disappointment. That disappointment doesn't go back to the charging company that's making the money off of that. That comes back to the car manufacturer who they think promised them something when we didn't actually do that. But charging costs. So if we could stabilize charging costs, advertise one charging rate throughout the state, that would be a very, very helpful thing. And given Oregon's use of renewable fuels, particularly hydro, that makes things.
Representative Vile mentioned Blink. How many companies are there out there that are providing commercial charging service?
I can think of at least three or four off the top of my head, and I believe there's about a dozen that provide. Okay. And these companies are in it to make money. So they're charging, and then there's also time of use charges and many other things. So the rates can change, but it's very complicated to figure out what it's what it's costing you to charge a vehicle.
Thank you.
In Oregon, it's actually relatively simple compared to other places like California, where I live. But that is definitely a barrier. The next thing that I'd like to discuss just very briefly is residual values of these vehicles. Zach put a chart on, and I apologize, I keep thinking of Jeff Allen, the director of Forth, but Zach is here today. Zach put a chart up that showed the residual value of some of these vehicles and how inexpensive they are to purchase on the used car market. Well, that's great for the used car market. It's not particularly good for the new car market because as residual values go down, lease rates have to go up to compensate for that. So if the idea is to get more vehicles into the market, those come from new vehicles, not from used vehicles. So we really should consider some sorts of programs for increasing the residual values of vehicles. Maybe states, municipalities buy the used vehicles coming off the market to keep the values up so that we can encourage more new car sales. But if we want more new cars, we have to keep, and it sounds maybe counterintuitive, but we have to keep the residual values up. Otherwise, the lease rates for these vehicles, for the new vehicles is going to go up. One other interesting side note is the barriers to the entry of these vehicles is the cheap price of gasoline. Let's face it, let's put it right out there. Cheap gasoline is encouraging people to buy bigger vehicles, perhaps more than they need, but this may be their one opportunity. And I'm not here to knock gas vehicles at all. But I am saying that cheap gasoline prices are definitely a barrier to entry for electric vehicles.
Vice Chair Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So forever and ever, we've kind of gauged our price, you know, how many miles per gallon, and we probably don't even go deep into how much is it costing me per mile. And so if a vehicle gets, right now, gas is $2.70, a vehicle gets 27 miles per gallon, it's about 9 cents per mile, I'm guessing. So how can we get a gauge of how many cents per mile it costs to drive an electric vehicle? What are there any standards? Are there any standards that are being developed so people understand the true cost of driving one of these vehicles?
No, and that's why I list it as a barrier to adoption. We really do need these standards, and we need to develop them so that we can tell people on the eastern side of the state who aren't getting a lot of hydro and other electrical renewable energy sources that are relatively cheap, what it's going to cost them versus what it's going to cost somebody on the western side of the state. So that is very clearly something that we need to overcome in this industry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One more quick barrier to entry is the limited opportunity for incentives here in Oregon. In Oregon, we don't have a lot of HOV lanes. Well, parking isn't prohibitively expensive in most places. Maybe in Portland and other places it does get a little bit more expensive. You have already a pretty good charging infrastructure available in the state. I mean, it's not that hard to find a charger in Oregon. So the last incentive that we really have is cash on the hood, when we know that's what moves vehicles. So we've been kind of fighting with one hand behind our back here in Oregon, as we have a federal rebate and we have the auto manufacturers incentivizing the vehicles, basically offering them at the same rate as their internal combustion engine or ICE equivalent, and yet no opportunity to make up that cost. So the auto manufacturers are incentivizing them, the federal government's incentivizing them, but the state really hasn't come to the party yet. And one of my friends describes it as, hey, we're having a party, everybody bring a dish, but we really haven't seen the dish come from the state yet. So we have been lobbying and actively engaged in seeking out incentives for vehicles in Oregon, and we hope that this will be the year that we break through. The last thing, so that was the last thing that I was here to discuss, was the necessity for incentives, preferably at the time of sale, at the point of purchase for vehicles. The federal government offers $7,500 federal income tax rebate, which is great for people who can wait that long, Or it's great for people who lease vehicles because the leasing company takes advantage of that right away. But it's not really good to help people with the down payment or things like that. So if we can offer an incentive, do it at the time of the point of purchase, it will go a very long way towards helping us see an increase in sales in electric vehicles in Oregon.
Thank you very much. Questions? Mr. Freeze, welcome.
Good morning, Chair McEwen, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Freeze, here on behalf of the Oregon Business Association and Associated Oregon Industries. Also, for the record, I am not an engineer, so any of the technical questions around EVs, I probably won't be able to help you with. But what I thought I would do is talk to you a little bit about AOI and OBA and where we've been on this particular subject matter, especially as it relates to EV infrastructure and incentives. So we represent about 1,600 member businesses from across the state who employ about 250,000 Oregonians. We're spread out from across all corners of the state. We have members that rely on all modes of transportation and all technologies. And so when it really comes down to it, when representing our members, we're relatively agnostic because businesses need a lot of need alternatives in how they transport goods and how they transport employees and how employees get to and from work and to and from schools. This winter, the two associations worked together to develop some joint policy positions for alternative fuel vehicles. Our joint associations adopted a policy support of both alternative fuel vehicle infrastructure investment and incentive programs. Our members recognize that transportation, cars, and trucks represent a growing portion of Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions, despite the fact that combined fuel economies continue to improve. The proportional change, I think some of it isn't all bad news. Our economy is doing better and people are moving to the state, yet we do see increasing challenges in how to continue to lower not only just per capita emissions, but also emissions that occur within the state's borders. During the conversations around policy development and what we would like to see, it became fairly clear that our members support incentives that can help speed up the adoption of growing cleaner technologies in Oregon. A report by OBA, I think in 2015, found that consumer incentives were more effective at market transformation than for electric vehicle rather than the infrastructure. As previously mentioned, our infrastructure has gone in, and now we just need to provide the vehicles to use those stations. Market transformation is important for Oregon to continue to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions, and the challenge with incentive, as you all know, is it often comes down to money. Where do we get the money? For decades, Oregonians have invested heavily in cleaner energy and carbon reduction efforts. These investments have helped reduce Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions, and it's time to evaluate those investments to ensure that consumers are spending their money achieving the best outcomes possible and most efficient ways, most greenhouse gas reductions per dollar spent. For EV incentives, we believe the resources for those incentives may already exist under current programs because general and lottery funds are already strained. We've talked about transportation infrastructure and asking consumers and taxpayers for more money. We need to look, pardon the pun, under the hood to see where what programs are working, what continue to work well after being in place for decades or some only a few years, and see if there are options to move money from one program to another to make sure that that if we do agree that this market transformation is important for Oregonians, to move Oregonians and to reduce our carbon footprint, that we're able to do that through providing incentives. We also believe that this session offers a very unique opportunity with the transportation bill and the good work from you all to develop a bill, and that this should be part of that conversation. With that, I know we're short on time. I'll happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Freeze. Questions for this panel? Vice Chair Vile.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One technical and one policy. Technical question, maybe, Ross, you can help me with this one. Gearing. I noticed that highway speeds reduce the efficiency on the battery, and city speeds, I get a lot more range. Is that a gearing issue, or what is going on there?
So it's a very interesting question. Electric vehicles don't have gears.
Right.
They have the motor that operates at one speed. As was described earlier, a lot of regenerative braking that you would see in the city puts the energy back into the battery. When you're at the highway, you're not using that regenerative braking, so the range on highway is actually reduced versus range in the city.
So it's just the regenerative braking.
It's just regenerative braking. Okay. And to clear up an earlier question about the regenerative braking that I think the chair had, instead of generating heat, which brakes generally do, that heat energy is transformed back into the battery and through the regenerative cycle. That's where the savings are. The brakes don't generate heat. Brakes that don't generate so much heat use less friction therefore increases brake life.
That's helpful. Thank you so much.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
One more question, yes.
Yeah, one more question. The policy issue. Several of the members of this committee have been on the Joint Transportation Committee, and we all know that we're really kind of concerned about where things are going. Right now, we're funding a lot of our transportation needs in Oregon with a gas tax. If we continue policy-wise to push the electric car, do we need to also change our policy to a weight mile tax type of structure, more like we do for large trucks, if we're not going to degrade our ability to generate revenue for our transportation system?
Chairman McEwen, Representative Vile, we have a short-term need and we have a long-term need, and I think the way we think about this is the gas tax is still necessary for and registration fees for maintaining and improving the infrastructure that we have in place. But I do think that it's important to start thinking beyond the next 5 years when we do see increased electrification and making sure that everybody is paying, you know, their fair share for operations and maintenance of the system. How that's done is a more difficult question, whether it can be done at a charging station itself or if it needs to be done somewhere else, and like an annual fee. So I don't have the best answer for that. I do think that it's an important conversation to have. I don't know that it's critical for this transportation bill, but certainly for the next, I think it will be.
Thank you.
No questions. Thank you so much for your time today, and sir, particularly for the travel that you incurred to get here today. We appreciate it very much. I'm sorry, Representative Wood had a question. My apologies. Stay put for 1 second. I'm sorry, Representative Witt. I got ahead of myself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and panel members. Mike, as a matter of public policy, if it's true that we produce relatively few electric vehicles here in Oregon, and most of the electric energy that's produced or consumed here is produced, if not in Oregon, at least regionally, and we're looking at incentivizing the future use of purchase of electric vehicles, would we be not better off incentivizing the fuel, in this instance, electric generation capacity, in terms of our interests in Oregon-produced energy, jobs, et cetera, as opposed to placing incentives on vehicles that are manufactured someplace else, when in fact those vehicles, as we've been told, already enjoy federal incentives that bring them into parity with the purchase price of combustion engines?
Chair McEwen, Representative Witt, that's a great question. The challenge is that we've identified is that we have greenhouse gas emissions that proportionally is growing in the transportation sector. And so what we're trying to identify are opportunities to lower the greenhouse gas emissions from that particular sector. I mean, that's the goal. And in order to do that, a big piece of trying to change that particular piece is to incentivize incentivize vehicles so that you have more people driving electric cars. Now, whether or not that takes money, in-state money, and moves it out of state is a different question, and some of the impacts of that. As a policy matter, there are people that will sell the vehicles in-state, and there's going to be an impact to that. Obviously, you add more people to the grid or more technology to the grid that stays in-state as opposed to going out of state. So I don't know what the long-term projection, you know, if you look at 5 years, but certainly there would be, you know, we would be sending dollars out of state, but I think we, in many cases, already do that. We don't have a lot of manufacturers in the state, whether it's internal combustion engines or EVs. It's just what type of technology would we prefer to stay in state, and that's, I think, the goal for us is that for some consumers, and in particular in the urban setting, electric vehicles seem to be a good option for them. Where I grew up in Jordan Valley, You're driving 85 miles to the grocery store, so that's not always the best option for them. But for our Portland members, this is an important piece that they would like to see, and a direction that they would like to see consumers go.
Thank you. Question answered.
Madam Chair, I think.
Very briefly, sir.
Members of the committee. Yeah, Ross Good, Fiat Chrysler. Places that have incentives on vehicles sell more cars. That's just flat out an undeniable fact. California, Georgia, places that have decent incentives sell more cars, get more cars on the road, which I think is the goal of the state and other people around here. That is the number one driver, and will continue to be for some time.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today. I'm going to close the informational hearing on electric vehicles and go straight to our informational hearing on the Washington County Transportation Future Study. And I'd like to welcome up first Mr. Singalakis. Was I close in pronouncing that, sir? Since I see you all wandering up, why don't we add a chair, and we'd love to invite two more? Okay, we'll do two panels then. Thank you. We have one other that's not on our list.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our committee this morning.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank you for inviting us to talk about the Transportation Futures Study. It's a pretty unique study that we've been working on for a while.
And your name for the record, sir?
Oh, I'm sorry. Andrew Singalakis. I'm the Director of Land Use and Transportation for Washington County.
Thank you so much.
Chris Deffenbach was the project manager for the study, and I also have with me Andy Smith, who's the Government Relations Manager for the City of Hillsborough. Let's see.
Madam Chair, if I might just make one comment, that both Representative McLean and I have been working a lot with these folks in Hillsborough and the county for quite a while now, and I just want to say that this is a really good example. The legislature allocated, I think, $1.5 million for this study, and it's really quite an important study, and I really appreciate these folks being here today. I wanted to make sure that they knew that.
Yep, thank you,
Vice Chair.
And here it is, the $1.5 million that came in from the legislature in 2013. And for the purpose of evaluating the long-term transportation strategies and investments needed to sustain the county's economic health and quality of life into the coming decades. Originally, the City of Hillsborough pursued the funding, but it was thought that we needed to do something that was more county-wide, so the county ended up project managing it. And it truly is unique because it's not it's a study. It's not a plan. So there's no specific action that could come out of the study that would result in anything other than a recommendation to move on to a subsequent planning phase. And we also didn't want it to be limited to limitations in state law and funding constraints. So. With that, and we also want to look out 40 to 50 years, which also corresponded to the urban reserve. So it was sort of good timing that this all came together at the same time. We looked at three different transportation investments, and mostly they differed by the scope of the types of projects. The third package that we had major big projects in it. And we also solicited public comment to identify which projects to include, to really kind of throw it open so that people would really kind of, you know, think big about what the transportation future could be in the future. And there really was no big surprises. More people, more jobs, more traffic, more trips, more delays, more congestion. More people and more jobs and more transit demand is something that obviously we found through the study. Looking at an increase of 50% traffic in that period of time going ahead. So even though we were a little bit more efficient in the way that we have our plans going forward and being, you know, with higher density centers, you still will have a great deal of traffic in the future. And we looked at a variety of different things. One of the things that it did validate is that the county does have the Major Streets Transportation Improvement Program, where it's been creating a grid for the past, you know, 30-odd years, and that was a good investment to make. And we also looked at other things as well, like managed highway lanes and smart technology. And early on in the process for this, autonomous vehicles were just starting at that time, and we heard a lot more about that as we went in, looked at the study, and one thing that we concluded was we really don't know what the impact is going to be of autonomous vehicles. We're going to have to wait and see how that plays out. So some of the major projects that I'd like to
go back to that previous slide? As a former Energy Trust board member, understanding a little bit, probably just enough to be dangerous about smart grids and smart technology, can you give me just a brief hint of what smart technology looks like in regard to smart cars? Are we talking about something where there's information passing back and forth with traffic? Is that what that's about?
It's also setting up the arterial network so that the cameras that you see up there communicate information back, and in the future, they can be communicated with other traffic signals and other cars.
All right, great. Thank you.
So the three major projects that we'll talk about here, we took a look at increasing transit options, and particularly around Highway 26 in the county. A new transit MAX line going out that way would result in significant increases in transit ridership. It is a pretty big investment, but it's something that we're pretty confident could be a future transit corridor down the road. We also looked at a limited north-south options for north-south limited access roadways. Basically, what was called the West Side Bypass was something that had been on the books in the past. What we found, though, is that it really didn't take a lot of congestion off of Highway 217. And we've started working with ODOT. We hired a consultant to take a look at ways that you could scale 217 into a variety of smaller projects instead of having to do it all at once. And it would appear that that is a place that we should be focusing our investments, as currently a lot of talk about that with the state transportation package. And the thing that did end up coming out of this, though, was a new northern connector. Now, granted, it's basically a modeling run. That's what this whole study really was. So there's really no ground truthing in whether or not this could actually occur physically. But it really did take, and it goes basically from Highway 26 down to Highway 30 and then over to the airport and PDX, a significant amount of traffic and truck traffic off of 26 and through the Vista Ridge Tunnel in Portland, Washington County. Again, the cost estimate of $1.5 to $2.5 billion, we really don't know how much that would actually cost. It would most likely be a tunnel, which would have to be ventilated for hazardous materials to be able to go through. But it did have great benefits for traffic flow within the county. There was an awful lot of public participation that happened through the study. One thing that we did with the help of the city of Hillsborough was an online open house where a postcard was sent to every single household in the county, and it resulted in 5,300 participants, which is a pretty big sample. And also a random sample survey, and in all cases really found that there was a good balance in the county between people's desire for transit and also for a bettering roadway capacity. And just as an aside, I thought it was kind of relevant for things down here today. In our random sample surveying, we found 75% of the public was willing to pay $100 a year, and a pretty big number, 48%, were willing to pay $300 a year for transportation investments. And the thing that really is, I think, the most important benefit for the study was the creation of a traffic model that can look 50 years into the future. We've already started using this in other applications. We are starting to take a look at our urban reserves and what that roadway network would look like. This model is a key tool for that as well. And we really did get a good understanding of where the public is in terms of transit ridership and also the desire for bettering the roadway network as well. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Vice Chair Vile.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Andrew, talk, if you would, just a bit about the limitation that we have with rural reserves and the creation of new roads.
Right, and that's one of the things that we ended up wanting to do. Right now, you can't build additional roadway capacity in rural reserves or new roadways. So one of the recommendations that we saw here ended up going through rural reserves. And as I said earlier, we didn't want to be bound by existing state laws. We really kind of wanted to just get a sense of what would have the best impacts for traffic flow. And the study looked at that.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
So the, is the conclusion that you came to is that we may need to revisit the policy relative to rural reserves to be efficient in building out the vision?
Possibly. And there have been some mixed interpretations of this as well. You can't get an exception in a rural reserve for a roadway with roadway capacity. So that may have to change in the future. Right now, you cannot do that under state law.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thanks. You're next.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, Andy Smith for the city of Hillsborough. I just wanted to talk a little bit about why the city of Hillsborough wanted to do the study in the first place, and then now that the study's done, what we'd like to see happen next. So back in 2013, when the funding request for the study was made, you know, we'd come out of the recession, and the city of Hillsborough was experiencing significant population and economic growth. So for example, the process of getting South Hillsborough development ready was well underway. We were anticipating it to be the largest master plan development in the history of the state, with 8,000 new housing units and 20,000 new residents over the next 20 years. And at the same time, North Hillsborough had established itself as the employment center for Washington County and for the region, especially for large industrial users, and it had a large concentration of jobs. We looked around the region and realized that it was growing and was going to continue to grow, and that all of this growth was really putting a strain on our transportation infrastructure, you know, manifesting itself as increased commuter and freight congestion, which we thought would only get worse into the future. Another motivator that for our city, I think, is that our city has a deep appreciation for the history of leadership in Washington County when it comes to prioritizing and investing in transportation infrastructure, not only at the elected level, but also the willingness of our voters to fund those investments. You know, we really view transportation infrastructure as the backbone of our economy. And so part of that motivation of the future study is wanting to carry that leadership forward into the future to maintain and accommodate future growth and the quality of life in the area. So through this study, we were not looking to set policy, as Andrew described, but really instead wanting an honest analysis of the options so we can plan for and address our future transportation needs. So looking forward, our interest continues to be to use the study as guidance and to figure out ways to advance some of its key findings. And for example, we need better north-south connectivity in Washington County and mobility for both commuter and freight traffic. So we'd like to take a look at enhanced arterial connectivity from I-5 to Highway 99 along the Sherwood to Hillsborough corridor and then from Hillsborough to Highway 30. We also think it makes sense to further study alternative options for north-south freight mobility along the I-5 corridor, as well as taking a look at transit in our area, looking at high-capacity transit on Highway 26, enhanced West Side Express service, and improved bus service within Washington County that really better connects our neighborhoods to our employment centers. So in closing, you know, we see this as a roadmap to address our future system needs, and we'll want to work with our state and regional partners to advance some of these key findings so that our city and our county and our region continues to be a great place to live and to do business. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much for being here this morning. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative McLean.
Andy, one of the things that you just mentioned, I want to understand, because I got an update on this, you know, back in the end of August or something. But what you just said was interesting, because was there some kind of an interaction between the statewide, countywide, and cityscapes, you know, as far as, you know, I was thinking about going overpasses over TV Highway and those types of things to get people actually out of this very large area of New Hillsboro or South Hillsboro. And so was there something there? Because I don't remember seeing it in the report.
You know, there is one thing that we're starting to look at. It's called the Around the Mountain approach. So basically it goes from 175th over into Cornelius Pass Roadway. And we have in our long-range planning work program this year starting to take a good look at that.
And can I just one follow-up?
Follow-up.
What I think is important about this, both because you did it as a study, not as a plan, but also just the interaction between state facilities, county facilities, mm-hmm. and city facilities. We all know we interact and we impact each other. So I think it's important for dialogue and studies and future conversations to really talk about some of those interactions.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Bile?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In case I forget, Fran Porter and her group are actually meeting with us on the 13th of June to talk about that Round the Mountain piece. But what I've noticed is between Newburgh and Hillsboro, we seem to have just a whole lot more traffic than we did before, and it seems perhaps that the population of Newburgh is beginning to work more and more at our industries in Hillsboro. Are we looking at anything on a south, sort of a southern more connector concept? You didn't mention anything. I just wondered.
You want to take that, Chris?
Yes, we looked at...
Your name for the record, please.
Chris Deffenbach, and I'm with Washington County.
Thank you.
And we looked at various ways to connect between I-5 and 99W with different arterial configurations and more limited access. So that's one way. We also looked at, as Representative McLean mentioned, the interaction between the arterials and the state network and improvements on Highway 219, which... You know, and sort of what can you do in some of the rural roads to accommodate that traffic? So we did look at that. It is, you know, it's outside of our region. So it's something we're going to need to watch to see those traffic counts and how they change and how that grows. Because it's not as easy to model because it's just a little bit outside of our what we really can more easily model.
And follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will say that the roundabout, for example, at Shoals Ferry and River Road has made a huge difference, but we've got 6 or 8 intersections in that area where the backups can be 1 mile or 2 miles long during rush hour. So I'm hopeful that we can look very carefully at some of those issues as well.
And some of them have been programmed in our upcoming MISTIP 3 project, Farmington and River Road.
I promise this is the last one.
Oh, yes. Representative McLean.
What you just brought up, you talked about Fran, who I think is a former Intel.
Yes.
Yes. So that interaction between Hillsboro and Beaverton also mm-hmm. is part of all that interaction yeah. and certainly has to be part of further conversations.
Yeah. Okay.
Complete. Any other questions for this panel? All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Senator Starr, it's a delight to have you on our committee this morning. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, Bruce Starr, former legislator, resident, City of Hillsboro. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's my privilege to be here to testify briefly as it relates to the Washington County Transportation Future Study. 2013 seems like just a minute ago when the legislature was gracious and kind and generous to provide $1.5 million to Washington County to look at these issues. And here we are today to talk about the results of that study. I'm going to be relatively brief and let Deanna talk, and then we can, if there's questions, we can have that conversation. As you look at Washington County in the Portland metropolitan region, I think you recognize that it's a place of high-tech employment. There's a lot of growth that's occurring in Western Washington County. There's a lot of growth that's occurring in Southern Washington County. And based on the urban-rural reserve conversation, we really know where people are going to live. We know where people are going to work. And the goal of the study really was to look, okay, we have this idea where these folks are going to be when they go to bed at night. We have an idea where they're going to go to go to work. What are we going to do as it relates to making sure that there's an efficient and effective way to make sure that folks can get in and around the county, both within the county, and then they're recognizing that there's a lot of folks that come into Washington County to work, and to have a long-range view about not just, you know, we're always looking in the rearview mirror, it seems like, you know, we're trying to catch up. This is an idea of let's get in front of this conversation as much as possible, and that's was the benefit really of the urban rural reserve, because you're talking about a lot of years into the future. So it's no great surprise, and as Andrew mentioned, that goodness gracious, there's going to be a lot more people living in Washington County 50 years from today. There's going to be a lot more people working in Washington County than 50 years into the future. The density in Washington County 50 years in the future is going to be more dense perhaps than Portland, than the city of Portland is. Think about that if you've driven on Highway 26 going out to the coast from Portland, or out Highway 99 out to the coast from, you know, Tigard in southwest Portland. Think about what that would look like kind of as you try to picture this. What it means if we don't do anything is that life is going to get a lot less livable for the folks that that live and play and work in Washington County if we don't do anything. And the goal of the study is like, okay, what can we do to ensure that Washington County continues to be the kind of economic engine that helps to power the state, that kind of be the place where families want to live and where we want to raise our families. At the end of the day, the results are we need to invest a lot of money in a lot of different things. There's not a silver bullet that answers all these questions. As you have more and more folks living, working, and playing in Washington County, there's a need for additional transit investments. And those are identified in the study, where we ought to invest in transit. High-capacity light rail, more bus services, more connectivity. The need to continue to invest in active transportation investments, walking, biking. Again, as you have more density, the opportunity for that is greatly enhanced in the long term. But we shouldn't just automatically think, oh my gosh, that's enough. Because quite honestly, it's not. We have to continue to invest in folks that get in their cars and drive. We've got freight that needs to move. And the study is really, really clear. If we don't invest kind of across the board, but if we don't invest specifically in expanded arterials and new capacity in our freeways, the kind of delays that are going to occur are really going to choke our economy and choke the opportunities for continued economic growth and healthy and a healthy living, not only for folks that live in Washington County, but the folks that work there as well. I mean, just one fact that came out: truck delay, without any investment, truck delay would be projected to increase four times. Freight traffic, for the most part, goes on freeways. And if we don't invest in freeways, truck delays coming out of in and out of Washington County is going to increase four times. So that's just one fact point that came out during the study. There's the need to continue to study additional. I mean, part of the process is okay. We've got this plan, but there's parts of it that we need to continue to look at. We need to continue to look at, how do we best invest in transit? How do we get the most bang for our buck there? We got to look at the north south transportation movements, whether it's from I-5 through Sherwood, from Sherwood through up into Hillsboro, but also from Hillsboro going continuing north. You've heard a couple of things this morning. You've heard around the mountain, and that's about the connection south from Hillsboro going south. You've heard about the Northern Connector, which is basically Hillsboro going north into North Portland. Those are things that we really need to get our arms around. We need to study those. We need to identify what it would take to get from where we are today to potentially having those projects constructed. High capacity transit. The study identifies an additional light rail line coming out Highway 26 from the Sunset Corridor or from the Sunset Transit Center out toward the North Hillsboro Industrial Area, where there's going to be, I was going to say tens of thousands, but likely tens of thousands of new folks working. Extending and expanding the utility of the West Side Express Transit that goes from Beaverton down into Wilsonville, making sure that has additional capacity is going to be critically important. So all of these things are exciting, and I think they point to the need to continue to invest. My hope is that that this is the beginning of a conversation about investing in these areas in Washington County, the need to move forward. Ultimately, the study had 100 or 1.5 million from the state. There was additional money that was spent at the local level. I don't know. Maybe it's a couple million bucks total. I don't know the exact amount. But my hope is that you don't just have a study that sits on the shelf and, a decade from now we look and say, oh, wasn't that great? We had that Washington County Transportation Future Study and, nothing happened going forward. My goal is as I continue to live and work and have family that's in Washington County, that we don't just have a study that sits on the shelf, but that we are informed by it and that we take concrete actions moving forward to see these investments that have been identified here move from, kind of concepts about and modeled concepts, not just, blue sky kind of out of the blue. I mean, just somebody had this grand idea, but they've actually modeled what this would look like and the improvements that it would do and how it would impact and improve the lives of folks in Washington County. Where we don't just leave it on the shelf, but we actually take concrete steps and move these projects forward. Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to be with you this morning.
Well, Senator, I have a couple of questions, and I really greatly appreciate your expertise in this field. So we're delighted to have you here today. To follow up on Vice Chair Vile's question about the reserve question, I'd like to understand what your perception is on if there's a way or how we move forward with dealing with that issue. And secondarily, these are large projects we're talking about with congestion between cities, truck delays, what do we do between Sherwood and Hillsboro, the Northern Connector, high-capacity transit. Is there some sense of priority for these? We know these things are big, expensive projects, and we know we can't, as we're very well aware, we can't do them all at once, and we're looking at a very long timeline for the package that we're proposing. Is there some sense of priority for what order these should go in? And I think I want to preface this with a number of us, as we did our travels around the state, beginning to prepare for the rollout of this transportation package. When we did our listening tour, we visited Hillsboro. And it was absolutely stunning the amount of growth that's occurring there. I mean, for those of us who come from communities where just maintaining the populations that we have are challenging, I believe one of the numbers that came out was 111 people a day are moving into Hillsboro. And we looked at those vast areas where housing developments are going in and trying to figure out how to get sidewalks to schools that are being built that can't hardly keep up with the increase in population. It was just really, really very clear that you have a challenge on your hands there. So a number of questions out of that, but I would just love to know what kind of globally you think about all of those things.
So let me hit the prioritization one first. I think a lot of this is going to be driven by policymakers in Washington County and those that are of you that are sitting in the chairs there. But as you look at the needs and you look at where the growth is going to occur most in the most recent future, I guess, next, South Hillsboro, I think you look at investments in some of those round-the-mountain investments right away. And those aren't necessarily where you're building a brand new freeway. That's about straightening roads. It's about safety improvements. It's about making existing infrastructure work better in order to handle more traffic in a way that's safe and efficient. You look at the Northern Connector as a facility that is not going through agricultural fields. We're talking about expanding existing infrastructure there as well. Those kinds of investments, I think, politically are a little bit easier than talking about a kind of a whole new freeway system that's going through, purely EFU land. The challenge in the long term is to identify the appropriate connectors on the south side. Clearly, the connection between Sherwood and Hillsboro is the most difficult. But the study is really quite clear that those kinds of investments in the long term for the health of our communities are going to be important. That would require some changes in state law, and it would require leadership, and it would require some difficult choices. The transit side. My sense is that the high capacity transit on Highway 26 is, if I were to prioritize, I would look at that. I would look at continued investments in bus routes and capacity on the bus system. Again, that requires a partnership with TriMet. So all of this requires a lot of partnerships and a lot of leadership moving forward. And I don't know necessarily how else to frame it than that way.
That's helpful, sir. Thank you. Vice Chair Vile.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, you mentioned South Hillsboro. If you keep going south, we've got River Terrace rapidly filling up. We've got West Sherwood rapidly filling up. And now with the traffic between Wilsonville and Hillsboro increasing virtually every day, both being employment centers and both becoming big population bedroom centers as well. It seems to me that would be one of the key priorities, is figuring out how to manage that. I wonder how you feel about this concept of regional cooperation, that rather than leaving all of the transportation decisions essentially to a J-PACT metro-centric kind of planning process, actually beginning to shift that back out to the west a little bit and give some of the county city folks out there a little bit more autonomy to organize and cooperate with one another.
So there's no question, just based on where the immediate growth is going to occur, and you referenced them, the need to invest in connections is critically important, and I can see those investments done in a way that utilizes existing infrastructure. I can see the opportunities for us to expand that. How that cooperation occurs, those are discussions that need to happen on a cooperative and in a collaborative fashion, and I wouldn't close the door on any of those conversations if I were sitting in your chair.
One more follow-up, I'm sure. And then one other question, Senator. I noticed in the study that tolling was asked of the participants in the study, and it ended up being a lot more popular than anyone expected. Maybe not overwhelmingly popular, but can you talk about the concept of user pricing, congestion pricing, tolling?
Yeah. So it's not. I mean, it's not rocket science. We don't have tolling in Oregon. I mean, we have. I don't know when the toll was taken off of the I-5 bridge, but it was a long time ago. Oregonians, for the most part, don't know what tolling, how it works necessarily. It's used obviously a lot of other places around the country. So it's not surprising that it's less popular than other things. And yet there still seems to be a willingness to take a look at it. As we look, particularly on the northern connector, I think tolling makes sense, especially if you're going to build a tunnel. Then you have easy places that you can toll. This kind of coincides with the conversation you had in the previous conversation about electric vehicles. Congestion pricing, I think, regionally makes sense because it doesn't make sense necessarily to toll or congestion price one facility, because if you don't toll the entire system, you're just going to run into congestion in the next, you know, the next freeway you jump on or whatever. So I'm a big advocate of system-wide congestion pricing. It's a tough political challenge to overcome. There's no question. Tolling in the near term on new projects, I think, makes sense, and I think you won't get crosswise with our friends at the federal level if you're doing that. And you know, the tolling that's available today is electronic. You know, you don't need to have the toll booths. It's automatic. It's easy. And you know, I would encourage you as policymakers to continue to keep an open mind toward that, and especially as you're looking at building new facilities, use that as a tool to fund those things.
Madam Chair,
thank you.
Representative McLean.
Well, some of us have been working on the transportation package for over a year, and we've done quite a bit of study on congestion pricing, and also on tolling, and we've also had quite a few conversations with the federal U.S. Transportation Department on some of those issues. And I think, you know, if you look at the package as it comes out today, that you will see, you know, some of those strategies listed as potentials and possibilities for working forward. But one of the questions that the chair asked that I think is extremely important is, as we all know, because we have to work in a consistent fashion, as you say, in a cooperative fashion with all of our partners statewide, including our regional partners, 23 cities and 3 counties, that, you know, some of the things that you talked about in the studies and some of the things that I reviewed in the studies were not on any prioritized list that came, you know, from that tri-county area, and that there were some other, you know, ideas, concepts, and integration of the very things that you're talking about, whether it be transit or whether it be improvements for freight and all of those things, that they listed other items that were ahead, you know, of some of the things that we're talking about today. So I look at this as very informative, you know, for us to figure out how does this fit in with what we've been discussing and what the region's been discussing for years to get us where we are. And from everything that you've said, I'm hoping that you will help us try to sell this transportation package first, because it's one of those things where we need a lot of support here. As far as being able, as you point out, politically, to get this really, you know, innovative and, you know, very integrated intermodal, in an intermodal way, you know, in front of the public and in front of all of us, so that we can actually get something on the ground and actually get something that is not just thought about, studied, but actually built and or integrated in the system that we've got. And I'm feeling passionate, because we've got a lot coming on today.
Nice plug, Representative.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, clearly there's no desire to get in front of what you all have been worked on, and there is clearly a long list of improvements that need to be made in regional bottlenecks in the Portland metropolitan area, and I commend you for the work that you've done, and I wish you Godspeed and great success.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome. We have about 10 minutes. We have to move a bill at the end, and we greatly appreciate you being here, ma'am.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, Deanna Palm, president of the Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce, and a member of the Future Study Advisory Group. I will be very short. I support the work that was done in the study. Obviously, the business community is greatly interested in freight mobility as well as transit and commuter mobility as well. We truly support the work that you've been doing on the transportation package in front of you today, and look forward to helping and working with you to pass that forward. This study, looking at a 50-year horizon, quite frankly, a little bit difficult for those of us on the advisory committee with the challenges that sit in front of us today to actually think about, you know, what is it going to be like in 50 years? But I think really, really important to think, to get into that mindset of innovation and bringing modeling together, looking at options, putting those options out there, studying them further. I would just echo Bruce's comments about, you know, give us the opportunity to take what we've started with and continue that investment, doing a deeper dive on the discussions on those areas that look like they hold promise. The Northern Connector for freight mobility, really important, I think, for the business community in terms of, you know, how can we move freight more effectively, more safely, get it off of the areas that are where it creates congestion. It's certainly an economic issue for our business community, not only today but in the future. If we have businesses that want to locate, but they know they can't move their product in this market, they won't be here. They can't afford to stay. So I think that thank you, first of all, for letting us have this opportunity to talk with you about this. And again, thank you for the work that you've been doing on our transportation funding package during this session. And thank you for the opportunity to look 50 years forward. And I hope that you will agree that it's work that's worth continuing. Thank you.
We appreciate the work. We're looking at with 10 years of financing with a 20-year look, so we're paling in comparison to your futures view, and we appreciate the work that you're doing. Vice Chair Vile, and then we'll need to move on.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I just want to thank the Hillsborough Chamber. Deanna has been there as the executive for a long time, but the Hillsborough Chamber is very, very supportive, particularly of the transportation package that is going to be looked at this evening, and we really appreciate that support.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here today. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak very briefly to this issue? Okay, we have just a couple of minutes. Would you like to come forward, sir? Please, very briefly, we still have one bill to move and 5 minutes to do it. So.
Okay. Well, you're here for one of your elected folks in Washington County. I'm Dick Scout on the Washington County Board of Commissioners.
Oh, thank you for being here, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking the time to allow our staff to lay this out. I think your question of priorities is a good question. I think that discussion needs to be much broader, covering all the elected folks in and around Washington County and across the broader region as well. So there'll be a lot of discussions yet that need to come as far as setting priorities. And I think that's kind of all I really want to say at this point. It's going to be interesting times. And of course, bearing in mind that we're a county of almost 600,000 people, so there's a lot of players here, and we've got a region, Tri-County, really Clark County as well. We're talking millions of people here, so there's a lot that's involved here, and one piece of this is of course the question of the connectors, but there's a lot of moving parts in here, so look forward to more discussions and broader discussion with the larger elected officials all across the region in Washington County.
Thank you. We appreciate your good work. Welcome.
Commissioners and senators, my name is David Beam. I'm an advocate for special needs population in the state, And I want to approve this transportation bill now for special needs population. You got a lot of them are working, and a lot of them can't work because they got no way to get there and working for the jobs. So I was wondering if we get this done for this year, then the next year after we can save the money where we got, then we can bring it back to the next session. Thank you. And I would really like to see this done as soon as possible.
David, thank you so much for your testimony today. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
All right. Then we will close our informational hearing on the Washington County Transportation Futures and open a work session on Senate Bill 930. Mr. Walker.
Chairman McEwen, members of the committee, Senate Bill 930, we heard on March 10th. This bill allows registered owner of a vehicle to black out or obscure residence address, business address, mailing address, or vehicle address shown on registration card and on proof of insurance or other current proof of compliance. There is no fiscal impact and no revenue impact and no amendments, and this bill is ready to move as soon as you are ready to move.
Thank you, sir.
Chair McEwen, I move Senate Bill 930 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Meek moves Senate Bill 930 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none. Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Beretta.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Meek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Miles.
Aye.
Chair McEwen.
Aye. The motion passes. Do we have a carrier for this bill?
I'd be happy to carry that.
Vice Chair Vile?
Sure.
Thank you. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 930. We will not be moving Senate Bill 532A today. Next week, Mr. Walker, give us.
Chair McEwen,
we're wrapping up.
Yeah, Chair McEwen, members of the committee, next Wednesday we will start working on our interim work plan, and I have sent an email to you requesting subjects that we may want to take up during the interim. So if you could get those to me, then I can put an agenda together for next Wednesday.
So, committee members, what I would like you to do is think about things that we have not had an opportunity to visit in this session, things that you would like to learn about, maybe things that you would like to observe. Are there opportunities for field trips that you would like to take? We would love to hear what you think, so we make sure that we have a robust interim as we go into the short session. So please think creatively and let Tim know, and we'll start putting our agendas together for the interim. But next week we will have a discussion about those ideas that you have brought to us. We have no more bills before us. We have exhausted the Senate bills, and so next week will be our last meeting. I think we intend to wrap up next week with just a discussion about what you want the future to hold. So on that note, we're adjourned. Thank you all. So on that note, we're adjourned. Thank you all.